I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Mark Bittman, longtime food writer for the New York Times. We're going to be talking about his latest book, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. And you can learn more about all sorts of work that Mark's involved in at markbittman.com, markbittman.com. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. As we still continue to confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you to do your part, social distance, wear a mask in public, stay home, and by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation. Okay, to today's conversation, when a guy who's written up 30,000 recipes, and a lot of them for the New York Times, writes a book with the title Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal, I take notice. What drove him to write this? What changed in the world of food or the experience of Mark Bittman? And how will someone who clearly knows and loves food talk about how badly things have gotten? His subtitle makes clear that history seems to be moving in the wrong direction. Together, industrial agriculture and processed foods endanger public health, accelerate climate change, and poison the planet. One very specific indicator I ran across, an international meta study of nearly 400,000 patients published last summer in Obesity Reviews, found that people with obesity who contracted COVID were 113% more likely than people of healthy weight to land in the hospital, 74% more likely to be admitted to an ICU, and 48% more likely to die. Turns out junk has consequences. Let me just share with you and with Mark a bit of my own path with food. I organically farmed a couple of acres with two others in 1971, in Connecticut, off the Long Island Sound. Following the advice of Mother Earth magazine, we turned the soil, collected and spread chicken manure, released ladybugs, plucked ears off corn stalks, and ate them on the spot. We sold our produce by the side of the road and made a run every day to collect waste from two nearby grocery stores. The best stuff we ate, and the rest filled hills of compost. We harvested the final crops in the fall and shared them in a great Thanksgiving feast with our friends at a nearby commune. I stopped eating meat in 1969. I reintroduced poultry in the mid-80s, a concession to my first wife. I've always eaten some seafood. I eat pretty simply, and I minimize ultra-processed food. And really, for me, it's all based as much as anything else on just personal preference. Also, rather than talk about the environment, I view our work as the development of a healthy relationship with the rest of nature. And I find the broad, deep, ecological context in which Mark traces our relationship with food that feels right to me. Mark Bittman worked the food beat at the New York Times for 30 years. As a food journalist and columnist, an opinion columnist, and the lead magazine food writer. He's the author of 30 books, including How to Cook Everything, the series, VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6 to Lose Weight and Restore Your Health for Good, and How to Eat, written with David Katz, MD. Bittman starred in 4 television series. He's a longtime regular on the Today Show. His 2007 TED Talk, What's Wrong with What We Eat, has 5 million views, and he's won 6 James Beard Awards. He's also the founder and editor-in-chief of The Bittman Project. You can find that at bittmanproject.com. Welcome, Mark Bittman, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thank you for having me. And that was a wonderful introduction. Your story We'll talk about offline, I think, but sounds really great. Sounds really great.
I mean, it's interesting. You know, it was, as I say, almost all of it was preference one way or another. But, you know, in some ways, much of the rest of the culture has caught up with me.
Yeah, for sure.
So let me tell listeners, by the way, we're recording this conversation Thursday, April 22nd. And I'm just a little aside. We were originally going to do this 2 days ago, Mark, as you know. And at that point, when I was thinking about it, I thought, we're recording this conversation Tuesday 4:20. So I guess I have to ask about marijuana cooking, right?
Right. But today we can discuss Earth Day instead.
Exactly. Which I realized was, you know, very appropriate for the scope of this book. So first of all, how are you? How have you coped with the pandemic?
You know, I was freaked out and now I'm not. I'm vaccinated. I didn't get sick. I live in the country. It wasn't that challenging. I relished the time alone. I tried to do what I could to, my partner runs a nonprofit that is involved in feeding people. So I pitched in there. It wasn't a bad year for me, except for the horrors of seeing so many people get sick and so many die. But, you know, the year came to an end, and we knew 2021 was going to be better for a variety of reasons, and so far it has been.
Exactly. No, it is interesting how the anxiety, which I think so many people felt sort of just under the surface for the last 4 years, has not all the problems have been solved, but that just tension is gone.
Yeah, I mean, far from all the problems, almost no problems.
That's right. That's right.
Except the one big problem, or one big problem was solved. But I do, you know, I was walking around this morning and I was, I just felt really good, and I thought, I just, you know, you question it some, like, why am I feeling so good? And I thought, I think I used to feel good a lot of the time, but then I just had these years where you'd wake up feeling, oh my God, what terrible thing is going to befall us now? And it does just feel different. And I know for many people, it's not different. And even for me, objectively, it's not that different, but it just feels better.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and then we just hope that we can make this last. So I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and work and books and so on that we talk about. So can you tell us a bit in your own words about your path to the work you do today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. And I guess one question that I have in there is, when you started your career, did you plan or expect to write about food for the next few decades?
Well, the short answer to that is no, but I'll get to that. You know, when you were farming in Connecticut, I was first I was a student radical in New York, and then I went to Massachusetts and did community organizing for a few years, and I wound up, because it turns out I didn't know this, or I didn't have a word for it, but it turns out I have social dread, so I'm a terrible organizer. But someone said to me, you know, if you don't want to go hand out leaflets or ring doorbells, maybe you want to run the newspaper. So I wound up running this crummy little newspaper in Somerville, Massachusetts, but I learned a lot, and it was like graduate school. And I realized that's what I wanted to do, not run a newspaper, but write. And no one was interested in anything that I wrote until a couple of years later, 1980, when I started writing about food. And then I really don't know exactly what happened, but there was I was writing for one paper, and then I was writing for three papers, and then I lived in Connecticut at that point. Also, then I was the restaurant reviewer for Connecticut Magazine, which was a big deal, and then I parlayed that into writing for the Times. I wound up being editor of the old Cooks Magazine, which was later reborn as Cook's Illustrated. I was editor of that too, and on and on and on. And it was at no point, I mean, I would say until well into this career as a food writer, 5 years in, 7 years in, even 10 years in, I was not convinced that I was going to be a full-time food writer. I kept trying to write about other things, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, but I kept cooking and I kept writing about recipes and I kept getting better at that. And people kept wanting me to, or that is, I kept having success in writing food pieces. And then in the 90s, I became more regular contributor to the Times, and I wrote my first cookbook, and then I teamed up with Jean-Georges Van Gerichten, who's one of the world's great chefs, and we wrote a book together. I was asked to write How to Cook Everything. I was asked if I wanted a weekly column, a weekly cooking column at the Times, which no one says no to, obviously. And things were good. And then 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, I started to realize that I could write about more than cooking and still write about food. And it took me a long time, and it took me the example of, well, especially Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation, to recognize that I could bring the issues that I'd always cared about, issues of justice and fairness and class and race and gender, all of those things. I could bring those things to food if I took food more seriously and looked at it with a broader lens. And I started to do that and started to become interested in agriculture and nutrition and so on. And by 2010, I convinced the Times to let me write the weekly opinion column about food, which was obviously a big deal. And so I did, you know, I moved to the right floor on the the newspaper, and I got to hang out with the great opinion columnists at the Times, and I got to have my phone calls taken by just about anybody and write about pretty much any aspect of food I wanted to. And I did that for 5 years, and then I thought, it's time to back off a little bit and really concentrate on this. And the result of that is Animal Vegetable Junk. It took me 4 or 5 years to put this book together, and I couldn't stand the weekly deadline thing at the same time as trying to write a serious book. So that's a pretty quick summary of my career.
No, I think that says it. I'll tell you, by the way, I actually lived in Somerville a few years myself, right around the time that when I left Connecticut, I was back in Somerville and so on.
No, we've crossed paths. We're going to have a conversation.
Yeah, and here's, I will tell you the funniest thing, which I don't even remember often, but it's true. One of the coolest things about that summer, and longer than a summer, as we know, it was basically a season, right? From turning the soil to celebrating Thanksgiving. I ended up, I found a friend who had just opened a very small restaurant in Somerville called Peasant Stock.
Mm-hmm. I remember it. Yep.
And it's still there, by the way, which is amazing. And what I did was I would drive up to Somerville once a week with a bunch of produce and herbs and spices that we'd grown, and I would cook two nights at Peasant Stock using what I'd brought. And then I would go back and farm the next 5 days. Just an amazing experience, as you can imagine.
You were ahead of your time, that's for sure.
So this book, it seems to me, as you said, it's a place where things you've been passionate about come together. And when you said you realized you had to give up the weekly column, you didn't have to give it up when you wrote your other books, right? But you had to give it up on this book because.
Well, the other columns were cooking columns, and I'm cooking no matter what. And to write up what I cook into a form that other people can use, it's just become second nature. Animal Vegetable Junk took you know, we have an abbreviated bibliography in the back of the book and abbreviated notes, but it was, you know, if working at the Somerville Free Press in 1973 to 1976 was graduate school, this was my dissertation. So mm-hmm. I digested a lot of material. You know, a lot of people say they're history buffs, and I will say that too. I've dabbled in history I like to read nonfiction, and I have liked to read history for a long time. But to sort of concentrate on the history of food and food's impact on mercantilism, imperialism, capitalism, colonialism, slavery, gender discrimination, etc., land distribution, all of that stuff, I didn't know that. I mean, I had a vague idea, but I didn't know the details of how that happened. And I had to get up to speed. I mean, you talk to a lot of authors, and I'm sure you've heard this 100 times. 80% of what I learned, 90% of what I learned in the course of writing this book informs the book, but it's not in there.
Right. And
there's just so much stuff to process in a book like this. And I'm grateful for it, but I needed a lot of time.
Yeah, you even said, you've said that a model for you in this, in a way, was Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. Can you say, how you feel that and what sort of template that gives you?
Yeah. When I left the Times in 2015, I didn't really, well, I can back up a year. In 2014, when I started thinking about this, I was in New York and I desperately wanted to leave. And I didn't quite know what to do. And a couple of smart friends said, "You've always said you wanted to move to California. Why don't you move to California?" So I'm lucky enough to have had the ability to do that. I made some phone calls and I kind of found a job and a place to live. And I up and moved to Berkeley. And then I had a lot of time by myself, which was great. And I started to read more widely and think more broadly. And one of the things I read was Sapiens. And I read it and then I got the audiobook and listened to it so that I made sure I knew, made sure I actually understood it. And I thought, well, if you can look at the whole picture of humanity in a 250-page book or whatever it is for a general audience, then surely you can look at the history of food in that same way. And I started talking to my publisher, a great guy. He liked the idea. I don't know where this title came from, but it is original to me. And it helped sell the book, really. Mm-hmm. It helped focus the book. But Sapiens was an inspiration just because he did such a great job of telling the biggest story possible, or one of the biggest stories possible, in a, you know, really digestible, understandable, easygoing, and maybe that's not the right word, but
user-friendly.
You know, user-friendly, exactly, form. Yeah. Yeah. So I did try to, I didn't sit there studying it or model, but I thought that's the spirit, that's the world I want this book to be in. And I'm lucky enough to have people tell me this, but now I recognize it. I have a direct and what's sometimes called muscular writing style. It's very straightforward. It's not fancy. I don't use a lot of metaphor. There's nothing flowery. And I think it works in telling a huge story pretty succinctly.
Let me ask you something, which if you say that's just too hard to do, we'll move on. But there is a narrative to this book, and it covers a few pivotal points along the way to how we got in the relationship with food we have now. Can you do the sort of 5-minute version of that narrative?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. I mean, let me start at the end just for 1 second, because I want to explain, you know, sustainable to suicidal is obviously a sort of catchphrase. And things are bad in the world of food right now, but it is also important to remember that agriculture, which is sort of where this really starts, agriculture has made it possible for billions of people to live that literally have lives. People who wouldn't have been born or wouldn't have survived childhood otherwise. And if you value the notion that you know, whatever the number is, 12 billion or 15 billion people have lived and died on this earth, as opposed to what would have been maybe a couple hundred million without agriculture, if you think it's valuable for us to have had many lives, probably including yours and mine and everybody else who's listening, then it's been successful. So, and that, you know, we poison the earth and we poison ourselves and we use resources at a ridiculous rate and on and on and on. But, you know, much of this is in service of having so many people alive and many having quite pleasant lives. So I think that's an important kind of broad view. But
yeah, sort of set that up first and then right. Step back. Yeah.
So to step back, we came out of the trees 200,000 years ago. We broadened the scope of our diet. We were able to range farther afield geographically. We were able to increase the different kinds of foods we could eat. Our brains grew bigger. We got smarter at some point about 10,000 years ago, and it happened in a few places more or less simultaneously. The best known is the Fertile Crescent, Mesopotamia, the Middle East, whatever you want to call it. People recognized that not only could they plant seeds and tend them, not only could they herd animals into a closed valley and have control over them, they could do this year in, year out, and they could count on having crops and having animals. And that was the beginning of agriculture. But with that recognition came the recognition that if I'm planting crops, then those crops are not yours to forage. And if I'm herding animals, then those animals are not yours to hunt. And so this led to conflict, and this led to rules, later laws, and it led to eventually to class structure, discrimination, wealth, surplus. And fast forward 8,000 years or so, it led to what we're calling capitalism. It led to advanced agriculture. It led to growing crops more or less explicitly for trade, which is much different than growing crops to feed you and me and our friends and neighbors and our village and maybe our region. But to say, I'm going to specialize in growing corn or wheat. Wheat was really the first big commodity crop. To say, I'm going to specialize in growing wheat, and I'm going to get as much wheat as I can and sell it all, and I'll worry about how I get my food in a different way because I'll have money. And that was really the beginning of mercantilism, capitalism, and eventually colonialism, because in Europe especially, where the farmland is not all that great compared to many other areas of the world, as the population grew, and this goes back to where I started, the agriculture made it possible for more people to be born and to be cared for. More people needed more food, which meant more agriculture. And that cycle has continued until now. Europeans plain started to run out of land. They were more dependent on animals than they were on, than other places were, and animals require more land than growing crops directly to feed people does, or do, I guess. And so, although the Europeans were not the most adventurous or technologically advanced civilizations in the world, the Chinese pretty much had that distinction at that point. What the Europeans did have was a need to go find land, and that drove exploration, and that was really the driving force behind the so-called discovery of the Americas. And you could say the rest is history, but genocide followed, westward Ho and all of that. The distribution of land pretty much exclusively to white European males, and we're living with that legacy to this day. Slavery, global trade, all of this follows. And fast forward again to World War I, when commodity agriculture really started to mature, the development of the tractor, of hybridized seeds, of the first chemical fertilizers, the first chemical pesticides, all of that happened around the time of World War I. The development was slowed a little bit by that war, and especially by World War II, but by the post-World War II era, that kind of agriculture, chemical-driven, mechanized, commodity agriculture, growing one crop at a time almost exclusively, and then trying to figure out what to do with that crop in order to make it profitable, the consolidation of land and of food companies and so on, that brings us to pretty much to today. And that description is maybe a different story or a different, let me catch my breath for a second.
Yes, yes, yes. Very good. Very good. And we're pretty close to the halfway point. Let me just tell people that I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm speaking with Mark Bittman, longtime food writer for The New York Times, author of 30 books. And we're talking about his latest book, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. And you can learn more about his book, his work, the Bittman Project, Heated, etc., some of the projects that he has ongoing at markbittman.com. And it's Mark with a K and Bittman with two T's, markbittman.com. So we've set up kind of how it started, how it's moved. I'm going to read three quotes from you, and then I want you to flesh out the problem we face. And I often ask this question is, how is such and such broken? You know, how is our voting system broken? How is our healthcare system voting? You make the point that for some people, the food system isn't broken. So I'm not going to use that, but here's the quotes. Food in the United States denudes the soil, poisons the soil, air, land, and so on, tortures animals, underpays people for their work, and on and on. If something other than the food system, say an invading army, were to do that, you would mobilize the troops and get to work fighting it. Until now, many of our food-related problems could be chalked up to ignorance. That's no longer an excuse. What are we reaping from what we've sown, to kind of torture the metaphor?
Yeah, I guess. You know, the ignorance, I don't know why I start at the end instead of the beginning habitually, but the ignorance is no excuse thing fascinates me, because you talk to a lot of forward thinking people, and again, I'm sure you've had this conversation, but we've never known as much as we know now. I mean, that's a fact. And a lot of the things that have happened in the past were mistakes, but they were often mistakes born out of not only greed, not only power seeking, but literally ignorance. We couldn't have known that using chemical fertilizer was going to be bad for the soil. We couldn't have known, well, we probably could have known that using pesticides was a dangerous thing, but we couldn't have known that raising animals in captivity was going to go to the extreme it's at now. But we do know these things now, and it's important. I think one of the goals of the book is to sum this up and to recognize all of the all of the mistakes, all of the things that we've done wrong. We haven't done everything wrong, but all of the things that we've done wrong have led us to this point, and it's time to try to find our way out of this. So it's very much like the climate crisis in that way. We couldn't have known that burning fossil fuels was even going to be polluting, let alone wreck the climate or threaten to wreck the climate. And it's the same with industrial agriculture. We couldn't have known that topsoil was going to get washed away so quickly, that people's water supplies would be threatened, that there'd be antibiotics in the soil, that we'd sell our souls in order to eat meat, which we've kind of done. And I haven't even mentioned the fact that the leading cause of death in the United States is chronic disease, and the leading cause of chronic disease is diet. So we are literally poisoning ourselves. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and that is because we have among the worst diets in the world. And that's a problem. And that's a situation we have to work our way out of. And we know at least how to begin to work our way out of it. We don't know what the end game is, but we do know how to turn this around. Of course, like so many other things, it takes political will. It takes organization.
Yeah. One of the things that I think underlies the point you make, which is that it wasn't an evil plan,
right?
You know, that has reached fruition. That so much of what we're dealing with is unprecedented, right? Monoculture had never been attempted to the scale we did.
Right.
Animals had never been, you know, cooped to the extent we did. So many of the things we now, as you say, we are no longer ignorant of, we know. And what we know now even is the effects on our health and the effects on our environment, that we didn't know. And partially I say we didn't know because we'd never been there before.
Right.
You asked two big questions that I'm going to, the first one is, what is food for?
Well, I ask everybody to ask themselves that question, because I don't think that food is for the benefit of big corporations and their profits. I think food is for feeding humanity as best we can in some kind of harmony with the earth. You know, you don't have to go too far down this road to start sounding like a little woo-woo, but ecology, you know, and you said this at the top, ecology is an important thing. And the oneness of people, land, water, air, animals, even rocks, that's not a joke. And we don't recognize that often enough. For us to survive, everything else has to survive also. And we're just a part of this picture. And, you know, that, again, that's something that maybe was part of religious theory or religion for hundreds or thousands of years. But now this is science also. This is known. We can't survive on a planet that isn't hospitable to everything.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, I was even thinking, I hadn't expected this book or your thinking or your voice in this book to go quite as broad as it does and quite as deep as it does. But it brought me back to think conversations that I had with guests 20 years ago that somehow I stopped having. But it was, I remember one of them was, how does the hypnotic hold of the mechanical worldview just, you know, how is it so strong that we have, science has known that all energy, you know, comes from the stars, and that there is only, you know, kind of one source of this energy. So in some, and that energy and matter, I mean, you know what I mean? All
yes.
That stuff we learned at the start of the 20th century, it's phenomenal that in practice, we still act mechanically. reductively. I often say that, and I'm going, I'm really taking you, you know, sort of to the height or the depth of this, but I often say, you know, the conventional view of reality is sort of that it's dead, separate, and static. And reality is alive, interdependent, and dynamic. And there's just no question.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we to go back to why it took me so, I mean, it didn't take me longer than it should have, but why it took me a while to write this book and to feel like I had enough of a grip on the material, I had to really learn or relearn from my college days about reductionism and about Descartes and Kant and some of the, you know, the Enlightenment era and post-Enlightenment era philosophers, and about Newton and the laws of thermodynamics and the fact that energy and matter can't be the sum total of what there is what there is. So if you use it and it expires, it goes into a different form, but you can't use it again. And to act as if, and this is obviously way bigger than food, but agriculture is a great example, to act as if resources are eminently usable, eminently replenishable, when they're not, unless you take care to replenish them, that is suicide. It really is.
Yeah, yeah, almost literally. I'm going to dig into this a little bit more. You write, the food system, and you've just said this yourself in a few minutes ago, but the food system is not producing food primarily to nourish people. It's producing food primarily to generate profits. And as I read that, I thought, so is it with healthcare? Mm-hmm. So is it with elder care? So is it with so many things if you go to Milton Friedman's shareholder capitalism, the shareholder profit is the only bottom line, or Margaret Thatcher's there is no alternative. But rules and regulations that include or pursue objectives other than profit can work. I think it's not insanity that we could actually make an objective like well-being, you know, of equal status with profit. And I just wanted to point out Rebecca Henderson of the Harvard Business School and Branko Milanovic, the economist, both said the same thing, that the key flaw when shareholder value as the only goal really, really becomes damaging is when you realize and act on the fact that one of the most effective strategies to increase profit is to overwhelm politics and government with money and write your own rules. And they said that's kind of the turning point. Once you begin to do that and get away with it, now capitalism is not going to work for the good of all.
No. I mean, it's questionable whether it ever worked for the good of all. But when you let profits dictate everything, then you're basically just saying all that matters is profits. And that, you know, if your goal is to say, if your goal is to answer the question, what is food for, or even what is society for?
Right. What is life for?
Right. And your answer is to maximize mutual well-being or to sustain the species in a healthy fashion, as opposed to benefit the most ambitious, the strongest, the most clever, most ruthless, whatever it is, those are two really different things.
Two different realities, absolutely.
Right. And it's not news about capitalism. I mean, it's just that it's so extreme at this point, and it's evidenced, as you said, it's evidenced in healthcare, it's evidenced in transportation, it's evidenced in income, it's evidenced in every struggle around labor, and on, even though, you know, there are studies that will show you that paying workers better does not necessarily impede profit. But, you know, you can make that case, but it's become so stark and so zero sum, that it's a, you know, the whole winner take all thing, yeah. Or it's
but,
extreme,
the,
but it's also
way,
it's unconscionable. It's just really unforgivable in a
but,
way.
But the specific point that Henderson and Milanovic make is that when the way to maximize shareholder value is to run the regulations, is to change the rules. And I think in this area, in the food area, that is so clear. The farm bill, time after time, has been not to deliver food and welfare to the American people or to the American land, but the goal for farm bill after farm bill has been, you know, to make it work, to make the subsidy system work for the subsidized farmers. Let me take the other big question you ask, which is, what would a just food system look like?
Right. Well, I ask that question, and I really don't think it's answerable, because we can all have our own fantasies about what a just food system or a just society, because you can't have one without the other, what that would look like. But really, since I've written the book, I've come to think it kind of doesn't matter what your fantasy is about that. It's going to sound great, but the real question is, what's the road look like? And when you ask that question, what does the road to a better food system look like, or what does the road to a more fair, more just society look like, you wind up starting to think in a way more practically about what the first and next steps on that road are. And someone said to me, I'm sure this is a commonplace thing to say, but I hadn't heard it, that you build the road by starting to walk on it. I had been saying you have to take the first few steps on any road to be able to see far enough down it to know where you're going. But whatever. The point is to start. The point is to turn the ship around. The point is to make some progress, not to describe some, it's nice to have a vision, but we don't have to agree on the vision of a just society or on the vision of a fair food system. I think we have to agree on what the steps are that need to be taken now in order to reduce injustice, in order to increase fairness, in order to maximize health instead of maximizing profits, and so on down the line. So I'm sort of focusing more and more on the kind of what is to be done question. Like, what do you do? What do we want to do in the next year, 5 years, whatever? The future's going to take care of itself, but let's get on the right path here.
Yeah, I like that approach. And I was struck in your conversation with Ezra Klein, in which he kind of said, well, I'm not sure that, you know, I think I'm going to paraphrase him. Tell me if you think I'm doing it correctly. But I think his point was, I'm so pessimistic regarding the political change and the cultural change that a just food system, or even a path to a just food system, would call for, that I'm putting my hopes in technology, and sort of challenged you to say why you thought good things might happen. And at that point you said, if we eliminate routine use of antibiotics in factory farms, if that means by reducing the use of antibiotics, we have to reduce the number of animals, well, that's two birds with one stone, if you will. And then if you start just supporting, as you said, existing clean water and air regulations, just enforcing what's there, that you can, that these steps, which are not a bridge too far, could begin to move us in that direction. Talk a bit more about some of the initial steps.
Right. Well, that's, you've named two of them. And, you know, it's funny, I was accused by a non-former radical friend. That is someone who in the 60s and 70s, we used to have arguments. He said to me, you've completely betrayed your 60s roots, because I described myself as an incrementalist. But I think part of, I don't really feel more conservative than I did when I was young, but I feel much less hopeful of seeing super radical change in my lifetime, in part because I'm wiser and in part because my lifetime is way shorter than it was in 1970. So, you know, I'd like to see, and these things are doable. Some of them have been doable for ages. I mean, for decades. They're all doable in the next 5 years, and they all are justifiable, make sense, and as I said, would sort of show us the way where we should go. I mean, if this stuff happens, then when it happens, I'll have a list of the five things to do next. It'll be easy. But right now, it is getting the routine use of antibiotics out of the food supply. 80% of antibiotics are administered to animals, not people, and it's increasing antibiotic resistance and increasing disease. And, you know, it's more than possible that people of our age will go into the hospital one day and there won't be antibiotics that'll fix whatever's wrong with us. And that's a shame. So that's one thing. And yes, that may make it so that it's more difficult to produce animals industrially. That's a good thing. I think if we enforced existing clean water and air laws, we'd make it even more difficult to produce animals industrially, which would be a good thing, not only for the animals, but for the environment, for our personal health, public health in general, especially for people who live around those factory farms, which anyone who lives near a factory farm is at a super high rate of risk of developing a variety of cancers. I think limiting the marketing of junk food to children, limiting the marketing of junk food period, but especially to children, is an important thing that could happen. We can't expect to have healthy adults or adults with a healthy attitude about eating until we teach children how to do that. We all know how hard it is to change our diets as we grow up, and that's because our preferences are really set when we're young. What else is there? Getting land into the hands of people who want to farm it well. I mentioned before that the land in this country was basically given away for free or nearly free, but almost exclusively, of course, at the cost, great cost to indigenous people, but it was stolen from those people and given almost exclusively to white European men. So the majority of people in this country, even then, but now especially, are not white European men, and they were shut out of one of the biggest land giveaways in history. So how do we get land into the hands of people of color, of women, of indigenous people, and so on? And how do we encourage them and help them farm it well? That's, you know, that kind of land reform, that's pushing it a little bit. That's not going to happen in the next 5 years. But the conversation can happen now. And it is happening. And there were some important provisions for Black farmers in the COVID Relief Act. And that was like the first really good thing that the Biden administration did, I think. And that's important. So I don't know. I might have said there were five things, and maybe I...
Well, one that you have said elsewhere, which kind of is in a different lane, is to fix tipped wage.
Oh yeah, labor.
Is the people involved?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, when I started writing the opinion column about food for the Times, people talked about animal welfare and everybody ignored labor. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was really unbelievable. And I wasn't the first person to write about that, but I like to think that I was early on in the bandwagon that said, yeah, great, I'm all for animal welfare, absolutely, for sure. But what about people who are getting paid $7 an hour to work, or tipped workers, where the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage for tipped workers, is $2.13 an hour. And the employer is supposed to make up the difference between that and the normal hourly minimum wage. But that doesn't often or always happen. And these are holdovers from racist laws, racist labor laws passed when the agricultural and service industries were dominated by formerly enslaved people and by immigrants, but immigrants not from Europe. Immigrants, of course, from Asia or South, Central and South America.
And also by women.
Yeah, and by women. So, right, domestic service as well. So there's some legacies here that linger not only in the food industry, but in others, but a lot in the food industry. The majority of the bad-paying jobs in this country are food-related. And, you know, this is stuff we can deal with. We can pass a $15 an hour. I mean, the fact that we're even talking about $15 an hour as a federal minimum wage, when everybody in their right mind knows that you need to make $30 an hour to have an acceptable by our standards standard of living. And we're talking about phasing in $15 an hour over a 4 or 5 year period. And we can't even pass that law. You know, now I'm getting angry, but
I'm going to point out one other thing that you mentioned, which I think is a pitfall here. I recently interviewed climate scientist Michael Mann, the one who is famous for the hockey stick graph.
Right.
His newest book, The New Climate War, he says now that they can't deny climate change because of the fires and so on, it's about distraction. Well-intentioned people focusing, arguing over personal behavioral choices, while the biggest contributors to climate change, the ones where it would call for collective action to take them on, don't get enough attention. I feel like something similar in the food world.
Totally, absolutely. And so, and in a way, I appreciate you're not going in this direction, because I think I've done something like 70 interviews for this book, you know, which is a lot.
It's only
been two. And I would say the majority, if not the vast majority, wind up at some discussion at some point talking about how should I eat? And we know how people should eat. Everybody knows, if I just say the two words, good diet, everybody pretty much conjures up the same images in their mind. It's not that challenging. And yes, people can do that, but that's not going to change the food system. And it's the same as changing your light bulbs. Great. Yes, most people can do that, or driving a Prius. Fabulous. But that doesn't, you know, the latest example of this, and it's interesting because it's both a climate and an agriculture issue, is the discussion of sequestering carbon. So what can, it's kind of a red herring, because there's nothing wrong with sequestering carbon. But that just, as you just said, that's a distraction from not generating carbon, which is really the big issue. You are not going to farm in a way that is going to start sucking as much carbon out of the atmosphere as industrial farming generates. And it is just like, if it's almost as if ExxonMobil or ConAgra or Monsanto or PepsiCo say something, you just have to immediately assume the opposite is the truth. I mean, it's because they're not going to say anything that's really helpful to the population at large.
Yeah, I remember there's this point where we're talking about change and we're talking about steps that can be taken. I know at one point, the point is raised that change will be resisted by those with the most power in the food system. And to some extent, they'll be inconvenient for the majority of customers in the food system. And so there are both, right? In other words, that's why you say everything is interdependent. Everything fits together. There are single mothers doing two jobs who do have to get dinner at a convenience store.
I mean, no question. And or at the drive-through window. And yet that's where the options are worst. And to get, you know, if you want to talk about making good food accessible, available, affordable, it's the drive-through windows and the liquor stores and the gas stations where that food has to be. So if you go to a McDonald's, your choices are bad and worse. And by the way, a salad you know, which McDonald's was forced to eventually offer, even though it's a complete joke. You know, a McDonald's salad costs twice as much as a huge Big Mac or quarter pounder or whatever. It literally costs twice as much. So that choice just becomes for people who money is a concern for, and those are the people most often using drive-through windows. It becomes just a stupid choice. So the bad choice is just the easiest choice for almost everyone.
Yeah, I mean these are obstacles to change. You've got about a minute and a half. what should people do? And I don't mean what should they eat, but how do we begin this path you talked about?
I mean, I think I really would like people to think hard about what food means and what food is for, where it comes from, and choose their own path as a result of their answers to that question. Someone once said to me, there's lots of good work to be done. And that is the case here. There's no matter what avenue you want to go on to try to work on building a better food system and or a better society, it doesn't take much imagination to figure out what you should be doing. In food, it could be, you know, it could be working on your kids' school lunch program, but it could also be working to have your U.S. congressman be one of those very, very few who actually takes food seriously. So, the range can go from gardening or changing your diet or whatever to running for public office and kind of everything in between.
Yeah, yeah. And your website will provide them some resources and direction, right?
It's a hell of a lot more useful than health.gov, which I was just looking at. Which, I mean, I know that that's sort of a non sequitur, but it just happened to be what I was doing before we started. And it was like, you people aren't telling anyone anything. But yeah. Our website is good. And Bittman Project, we are trying to cover the world of food from cooking to social change. And we're just getting started with that, but it's a good project.
So the website that sort of has everything, the articles, the books, and all of that is markbittman.com, markbittman.com. And the other is Bittman Project, Bittman Project, all one word, .com. So we got to bring this to a close. The new book is Animal Vegetable Junk. The websites I've just given you. The challenge is in front of all of us. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or a world that just might work, all one word, a world that just might work.com, to the same website. If you want to get my weekly announcement that'll tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 relevant and timely articles, you can sign up at my site or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. You'll find years of podcasts at my site and they're searchable by guest, which is not true at every podcast site. If you go to my site, you can hear Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Mark Bittman, and keep up your good work.